accession number 10170, reel number 5.
Walter Spencer, Reel 5. How did the weather affect life in the front line? When it was hot or when it was cold and wet, how did that affect life?
Well, not too much in the summer, but in the winter time, it was always an understood thing that every man who was in the front line should treat his feet with whale oil. We had tins of whale oil sent up, and everyone had to rub their feet. Now, if you didn't rub your feet with whale oil, surely, in time, you would get trench feet and frostbite. But it was really an order that you had to do it. You see, the sergeant had to see that everybody treated his feet.
How did you go about it? Where would you get the oil from in the front line?
Well, the oil came up with rations, and so much every night, and it was placed in different positions along the line, usually more in the dugouts or reserve trenches than in the front line. But everybody had to take the boots and stockings off, or the Wellingtons, and treat the feet with this. And it was a sure thing. I never had it myself, and I was in trenches all the winters, but some did get it.
What, did you ever see what the symptoms were, as far as you were concerned?
Yes. First of all, their feet started to turn blue, and then their toes would be kind of stiffened, and I have seen chaps with the toes almost dropping off with trench feet when they got it badly.
Were they punished? Because if the whale oil was supposed to stop it, shouldn't
they? Well, they did punish them at one time, but they stopped it afterwards because there were so many who, for some reason, just neglected their feet. But, of course, they were the sufferers, the men themselves.
What about frostbite? Did you have any of that in the front line?
No, they had a bit of frostbite, but it was chiefly, I think, by men not looking after themselves. If a man looked after himself properly and kept himself clean and used whale and all that kind of thing, he generally didn't get frostbite at all.
What about trench fever?
No, didn't got very little. I never knew a case of trench fever. Never knew one.
Any other common diseases that would come up, boils or dysentery, anything like that, caused by the lifestyle?
No, we had one chap once, it's rather amusing, but I relate it. We were back at rest, and the chap went to a Chinese camp, and they gave him some pudding of some kind, and he turned as yellow as a guinea, and he had to go to hospital with jaundice. This is a fact. No, I don't think we had any trouble in that respect.
Were there any? Did you have any health problems in your time on the Western Front?
No, I felt fine. Of course, I was just at the age when I should have felt fine. But I never. I was 12 stone 7 when I joined the army. I was 12 stone 7 when I left. So the rations were ample to keep me fit. And as I say, I always looked after myself. I didn't do anything I shouldn't.
I want now to look at the daily routine in that Ypres sector in 1916, although it doesn't matter if you include the odd bit from elsewhere, as long as you let me know. Let's start perhaps with the logical things. Start at stand to. What time would stand to be, or was it at dawn?
Well, usually it was at dawn, while you see, of course, as you know, dawn fluctuated according to the time of year. But generally speaking, it was somewhere round about 6 o'clock in the morning.
And what exactly did stand to entail?
Everybody had to man the front line trench. The whole of the battalion had to be on right shoulder to shoulder, you might say. And then they'd call the roll. This would usually be after there'd been an engagement. They'd call the roll to see who was missing and who'd come back, you see. That was all done in the front line after an attack.
But in the normal day, Would they call the roll?
No, in normal times you'd have sentries posted here and there, and you'd take your turn at sentry go, you see.
What was looking at in the day, what was the job of a sentry during the day? Would he have to look over the top, or would he use a periscope?
No, the only people who looked over the top were the sentries. The others were, you could be in the dugout or anything like that, playing cards, crown and anchor, anything like that.
I'll come to that. But you were on sentry duty, I presume, sometimes?
What's that?
You were on sentry duty.
Oh, yes, I did platoon. It came around in a rota, you see. In your platoon, perhaps out of your 60 men, there'd be about 20, roughly speaking, in the front line.
And what would they do? What would you do?
They'd have a periscope to look through if they wanted one, but they'd be walking about and perhaps talking together up and down a certain section. You'd have your section marked out from there to there, you see, and that's where these men would patrol.
And how often would you look over the top, and how would you look over the
top? Well, you wouldn't bother about looking over the top until you heard something, you see. You listened, or you saw a light shining or something like that, and then you get on the parapet. The parapet was dug out about 18 inches above the lower trench, and you get on there and just look through and glance all along and see what you see on no man's land.
What about in daytime? Wasn't there a risk in looking over the top?
You had certain points where you got your vetting, as we call it, or the sandbags went a bit higher, and that was usually your looking out point.
So you didn't use periscopes in your battalion?
Not generally, no. No.
What other duties might you be put on during the day? Would you be doing any repairs work or details? You've mentioned you could be detailed to the clearing up.
Yes, clearing up, that kind of thing. Generally, in the trenches, you're fairly free from any, what you call, work, except just for keeping the place tidy and clean.
What happens if there'd been a shell damaged part of the trench? Would you do that during the day or during the night, the repair work?
Usually during the night, unless it was too bad to leave, you see. If it was very bad falling, you had to get your men there all assembled and get it out as quick as you could and repair the trench.
How would you do that in daylight without putting yourself in view?
Well, you kept as low as you possibly could and kept building up, you know, building up with sandbags, you see, so you get the height again where the old trench was.
So, normally then, you didn't have much, if you weren't on sentry, you say you just sat in your dugouts.
Yes, you didn't have much to do. You could read, of course, you could even write letters and that kind of thing, if you were so. But we used to sit and talk mostly, sit and smoke and talk.
What were the sort of obviously you won't remember the exact conversations, but what sort of topic did you talk about most, do you think?
Well, general conditions of the war, and you talk about your home, people at home and that kind of thing. You get to know one another's, what you were working at before the war, and some of them would tell a tale to pass the time. And of course, you're always getting new recruits up, and when the old ones are gone, you see, well, casualties. So you'd always get somebody new who could pump up something which is interesting to the battalion. You say, where do you come from? You say, where did you work, and what made you join the army? How long have you been in? All about that, you see. He'd be telling you all about his past.
Was there much humour?
Oh, yes, quite a lot of humour. We'd usually get the current jokes from the newly joined recruits, you see, who'd just come out from England.
Now, your meals, would there be set meal times during the day within the routine?
No, there was no set meal time. That, was, of course, again, was dependent on the enemy and what the war was doing.
So you'd just eat when you could?
Yes, and sometimes you didn't get done any for perhaps 10 hours, and then you'd get what you could snatch, and then you'd carry on again.
What about sleep? Would you get a chance to sleep during the day?
Well, you'd sleep when you could, and if there'd been a big night attack, you'd be glad to sleep any time of the day, you see. And again, if it's a day attack and it was all over, you'd sleep at night.
But when there were no attacks, what about then?
Well, you could sleep as you wanted to, but of course, directly the sergeant said, stand to. Everybody had to be stand to and in the front line.
What would happen at night then, after the day? As you go into the night of our typical day, what would you do at night? Would there be a sentry rotor again? Did you have a stand to at night as well? At sunset?
Have a
stand to at night as well, an evening stand to?
Yes, you had a stand to about nine and 10 o'clock at night, generally. You see, you're under a very big difficulty at night time because there were no lights. You see, you couldn't have a light at all in the front line. You could have candles in the dugout, by the way. So if you wanted to read it at night time, you had to light a candle and sit there, and invariably he made it say, put that bloody light out, you see, and you want to get to sleep.
Were you ever put on working parties to repair a trench or any other work at night?
Oh, yes, yes.
This is while you were in the front line, not when you were in reserve.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, often you'd had to send a party out if something had happened outside. And the engineers had to go out and repair the barbed wire if it had been cut by the enemy artillery, you see, which was a very dangerous job, of course.
But you didn't have to do the wiring parties. The battalion
didn't handle barbed wire at all. That was in somebody else's province.
What about when there was a wiring party out? Would you have covering parties or anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes. You'd know if there was anybody from our side who went over the top, or got out of the trench and went into no man's land, you would know about it. Or he should report about it, or the sergeant would tell you. Don't fire. We've sent a patrol out or something like that, you see. And then he gives you the order when you resume normal and fire if you saw anything or heard anything.
But would you post actual patrols out in no man's land as covering parties when people were working on the wire? Defensive?
No. They used to take it themselves. They'd take their own risk. But they weren't out for long, by the way. If a wiring party went out, they work quickly and with a roll of wire, and they lap it round a couple of posts quickly and back again, you see, because there's all the star shells at night to contend with. If Jerry heard a noise, or if we heard a noise at night, he'd immediately be standing ready, you see, to see what it was and to shoot if necessary.
Did you have any listening parties or patrols or positions, listening posts?
No, that was chiefly left to the artillery. Artillery used to do the most listening because there were artillery officers in the front line always. If a battery of artillery came up, one of their officers and perhaps two or three men would come along and he'd make himself known, you see, and tell them that he was manning the listening post. There'd be at intervals along the front line trench.
Were they extended out from the trench or were they just in the trench?
No, they'd be in the trench. They wouldn't be exposed.
So at this time you wouldn't have saps going out into the front, out beyond?
Well, you did in some positions, you would have saps. You did in the Ypres salient, but the sap was always a bit of extra risk, we thought, because you'd get what they call inflated fire down a sap that you wouldn't get from a straight line, you see. If something came at an angle, you see, it would be exposed.
Did you ever have to man a sap? Man a sap. Were you ever put in a sap position overnight or for a period?
No. I think I cleared. We didn't often get saps, really. It was usually in a quieter part of the line, and we didn't negotiate any.
What about reconnaissance patrols? Did you ever have to go out on one of them?
Well, a reconnaissance patrol, the object, you see, supposing we went in tonight, we'd want to know who we were fighting against to start. Very vital to know what regiment was against you. So the officer would come along and detail so many men from a certain platoon, would say. Usually, for patrol, you send about six men and a sergeant. And an officer. Officer, sergeant, about six men.
Did you ever get picked for a reconnaissance?
Yes, I went out on several patrols. You got in turn, you see. If you didn't volunteer for it, you'd get in turn.
What preparations would you make before you went out at night on a reconnaissance patrol?
Well, usually you'd black your face.
How would you do that?
With a bit of cork and some black blacking. So, to make yourself less conspicuous. And of course, you walk on your hands and knees.
Did you have any special equipment? I mean, would you carry just your normal rifle and bayonet?
No.
Or would you have any sort
you
of...
You didn't carry a rifle at all. You carried two mils bombs. That's all you carried. And they would be carried in a bag at your side.
What about any clubs or things like that? Would you use them?
No, we didn't have any of those, no.
So it's just the mils bombs?
That's right, just a couple of mils bombs.
And could you take me through a typical thing? So what, you went out on your hands and knees. How would you get through your own wire?
Well, there were certain places which we knew had been purposely left for that purpose. They'd only be very narrow, perhaps a yard wide, you see, the gap in the wire. And that, of course, would always be covered by the enemy machine gun. That's the trouble. You see, he knew where the gaps were as well as we did. And if he heard anything, or if you trod on something, or accidentally made a noise, or even coughed, you'd get a machine gun turned on you. Then you wouldn't bother to return.
So what would you do when you got through the gap?
Well, you'd try and get down to a part of the enemy trench where you thought it was least manned, you see, and you'd grab a prisoner if you could, and of course he'd give a gawk, and that's when the fun started, because directly he shouted that they'd manned the trench, you see, and anything that was moving they would put on. But invariably you could get a rope to come, directly you got him out of the trench, he'd come with you, all right, and he'd get him back to the line. But it was a very hazardous job. We lost a lot of men on patrols, of course.
Do you remember any incidents from the times you went? Any?
No, I didn't go many times, but it was only practice, you see, generally speaking, when you had to establish what regiment you were. You wouldn't do it again during the time you were in there, you see, because so long as they hadn't reinforced or changed, they'd still be against you. You wouldn't have to do it twice.
Did you have? So you didn't have not fighting patrols out every night, so to speak?
No.
You'd just do this initial reconnaissance patrol.
That's right.
And
that's
then
it.
You'd leave them alone.
Then we'd leave alone, yes.
During this time at Ypres, were you involved in any raids? Were there any raids? This is in 1916, I'm thinking.
Do you mean the enemy raiding our trenches?
Either way.
Yes, well, Jerry would try and do the same as we did, you see, when he got in the line. He'd be curious, naturally, to know who he was against, and he sent in patrols the same way as we did. And so he would go on the same system that we did, and we had to look out for them. And if, of course, a chap in the front line had detected something, either seen anything or heard anything, we should put a machine gun on that spot that he located.
But you don't remember any specific instances of German raids during that 1916 period? From
No, I can't remember any individual peculiarity from a raid.
So we didn't make any full-scale raids. The British didn't make any full-scale raids either. Just these small snatch
No, not
raids.
Generally. They weren't advocated. You lost too many men on raids, you know. They're very costly.
Looking at the sort of routine fighting before we go into any major attacks or things during the period, what can you remember about the nature of artillery fire in the Ypres salient? Was there much of it?
Yes, in some positions there was a lot of artillery fire. That again depended greatly on the contours of the land. If Jerry had got, usually he occupied the higher ground, by the way, and if he got a higher ground position, he wouldn't need so much artillery as he would when he was on the level, because the machine guns could do it, you see. But artillery fire to us was not too bad, because he usually concentrated more behind our lines onto the artillery. You see, the artillery were behind us, and if he was firing any salvos, any big salvos, usually it would be as opposed to our own batteries, to try and knock those out. He would, of course, sometimes, with field guns, he'd shell the front line, but they didn't cause a great deal of damage unless the man was actually in that portion of the trench, you see, where the shell dropped.
Did you have different names for the different types of artillery or shell? Probably the shell.
Yes, well, we got to know what they were. We knew what the 5.9s were, and we knew what a 12-inch high explosive was, because you could hear it coming, whistling, you see, make a hell of a whistle before it exploded.
Did artillery fire make you nervous more than most things, or did you cope with it?
Well, you coped with it after a certain time. You see, you got used to all these dangers, really. Your body seemed to acclimatise itself to it, and when you've been in the trenches a few times, you just thought, well, I'm in. If I get knocked out, that's it. You get somewhat of a fatalist. You wouldn't bother about whether you're going to be killed or not.
Do you think the experience gave you the ability to tell where a shell was going to land, roughly speaking?
Well, you kind of got a sixth sense to know that if you were in direct fire of that shell that was coming over, or what it was, you'd know near enough where it was going to land within about 4 or 5 yards, because according to the whistle, you got used to the certain noises in the air. But the bigger shells always made a double row before they arrived. You see, you could hear the whistling in the air for perhaps 100 yards before it got to you.
What about the smaller ones, like the whiz-bangs?
Well, they were the nuisance, because they no sooner fired them, you could hear the gun go bang, and then it was bang in the trench, you see. That's why we call them whiz-bangs. But they were very small. They didn't do so much damage. Trench mortars were a bit of a nuisance, because they used to cause such a hell of an explosion and blow the trenches in so much.
Could you see that? How did you cope with them? Could you see the shell?
No. It was more the sense of hearing that you got them. But
what about the Minenwerfers, the German trench warfares that fired the...
Yes, well, they were a nasty, they were a dangerous thing. But, of course, the ordinary bomb was a very dangerous... They were all dangerous things, but we got to know by the sound of them as to what we might expect. And after they sent one or two over, you'd take it for granted they'd still be carrying on with the same weapon, you see.
So what about British mortar teams? Did you ever see anything of them in the front line?
Oh yes, we had mortar squads to each battalion, but they weren't of air regiment. They were a thing apart, you see.
Would they come into the front line often to fire?
Yes, well, they'd come in with each unit. Each division would have its trench mortar squad, you see. And they would be allocated according to how they required to put them out.
Would you be pleased to see a trench mortar team arrive in your sector, you know, to fire or not?
Would we?
Be pleased. I mean, were they popular?
Well, they cut both ways. They're very popular in the way that they could exterminate the enemy, but they weren't very popular when the enemy would use them on you, because they'd blow in a big section of the trench. If a trench mortar shell dropped in the front line, it had caused perhaps a hole easily 4 foot 6 each way and fairly deep. And that's when you had to start repairing your trench, of course. But they weren't used extensively, funny enough.
What about sniping? Was that a problem at Ypres?
Well, sniping was always a problem, because if Jerry had got anything tall behind him, if he was in the ruins of a house, we'll say, where we'd vacated and he'd occupied, he'd invariably put snipers at different points. Church Tower was a popular place for him to put snipers, and anything high, you could bet he'd have a sniper or two in that building, and they could see all around, you see, and pick men off as they went along. But provided you kept into the trench, snipers didn't bother. It was only when you're out on doing on patrols or anything like that when a sniper would pick you. Another point I'd like to emphasise about snipers is that they usually pick the officers out or the NCOs, and a private was usually immune from snipers. Generally, you know, if he could see anybody with any decorations on his arm, he'd prefer to kill him.
But when you were actually in the trench, as far as you were concerned, they weren't much of a problem.
Oh, no.
They didn't look for you looking over
no,
the top?
No, it was only when you got out in no man's land that you had a sniper's dealt with.
What about machine gun fire? This is not during an attack, but during sort of day-to-day life.
Machine gun fire was always a menace, and Jerry was all through the war. He was well in the ascendancy regarding machine gun fire to what we were. For a start, we hadn't sufficient number of machine guns. Early in the war, we'd only have about four machine guns posted to the battalion. But, of course, Jerry against her would probably have 40. And he had a good quick-firing gun, and he always had plenty of them, right through the war.
What about... did you ever use your own weapon, your rifle? Would you ever have occasion to fire that day-to-day rather than in a major or attack?
Well, there weren't many times in the trench that you didn't use your rifle, because if there was ever a stand-to and there was any semblance of a Jerry attack, you'd all man the trenches, you see, with your rifle, and then if you saw anything coming above that, you'd shoot straight away at it.
Would you be shooting at specific aim targets or just at a general area?
Would
you be shooting at a specific target or just at a sort of vague movement?
Yeah, it'd be rather vague because you try and get them under a distance, you see. Because if they came closer, you'd start to picking out individuals.
What about handbutt grenades? Your trenches wouldn't be close enough for them to be a problem to you, would you? The German?
No, they weren't really. No.
So that would only be an actual attack.
That's right. Yes.
Was there any mining going on in your sector?
Mining? No. I never was in mine. I've seen mines go up, by the way, to the left and right of us, but I was never in a mining sector. You see, there were certain sections of the line which gave the opportunities for mining, and there were certain that they couldn't mine in.
What about gas shells? Were they a menace? Gas shells?
Gas shells? Well, they came up with the ordinary artillery shells. So you used to invariably mix them. You'd perhaps get a high explosive shell from one battery, you'd get a shrapnel shell from another battery, and you'd get a gas shell from another battery, see, coming into your trench, yes.
What precautions did you have against gas? Was there any sort of an alarm system?
They were, at first, they were very, very bad. The old smoke helmet wasn't much good. Respirator. It was, to a certain extent, it kept out a little, but the trouble with them, you see, was when the vapour, which they had been immersed in, had dried up, the thing was no good. It was like an ordinary army shirt, really, and it had two eyepieces, and it had a nose clip, so you couldn't breathe through your nose, and it had a mouthpiece that you shoved in your mouth. And it was extremely uncomfortable to wear, and if you wore it for a long time, you'd find that your eyepieces would become dim, you see, dim up with the vapour from your breath. And there was very extremely uncomfortable in hot weather, especially. And 9 times out of 10, a bloke would rather chance his arm than put his respirator on, although it was a punishable offence. When you had the order to put them on, you had to put them on.
So that was the smoke helmet. What was the next defensive measure you were issued with?
You mean against gas?
Yeah.
We hadn't much else besides the smoke helmet, not in my time. But latterly, they started introducing the first version of the respirator that they're using now, with a tube and a canister. Had the canister down here, and that was filled with different chemicals which neutralised the gas, and you could really breathe through those nicely,
but
both through your nose and your mouth, and the eyepieces were a lot better.
But you didn't get them till late on in the war.
No, we didn't see them until end of 1917. They started the first one, and then they improved on it a bit toward the end of the war.
How did the daily routine of trench warfare affect you? Did you start getting very tired or very stressed? Any signs of shell shock?
No, I think I kept fairly decent all the time. I never went sick. I never reported sick all the time I was in the army.
You didn't find your nerves getting a bit on edge?
No. Of course, your most nervous time was early in the war, and then it wore off toward... as the war progressed, you kind of got used to things and took everything kind of for granted.
So for you, stress didn't build up, it got less?
That's right. You didn't worry whether you'd be going to be killed or not. That never entered your head.
Why didn't you worry?
Well, because I'm a bit of a fatalist. As long as self-worried hits me, that's it. And most men are of the same opinion.